there, fellow adventurers. I am Jason Conforto.
And I'm Tyler Crump, and we are hosts of a podcast, Adventure AI, where we play Dungeons & Dragons with an AI named Alex the Language Lord.
I'm Alex the Language Lord. Join us as we craft epic tales together.
Do you want to learn how to use AI in your D&D campaign?
Or how AI can force you to do things that you don't want to do? Wait a second, we don't like that.
Look no further. Adventure AI is the podcast for all your AI-powered D&D adventures.
Alex the Language Lord not only comes up with campaigns for us,
he also helps us create our characters, create our backstories, and even give us some fun magical items.
And really takes all of the human aspects out of Dungeons & Dragons. So it's not really playing at all.
Follow Adventure AI on whatever platform you listen to podcasts.
All right. Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of Mulling It Over. Once again, we're joined with Kayla Rivera. Thank you for being with us.
Yay! I'm so happy to be back.
Yeah, and I am Jason Conforto, host of Mulling It Over with Brandon Mole. Today we are sans Brandon Mole.
Who needs him?
But,
yeah. he's great.
You can't replace Brandon with an individual, so we have a committee.
Yes.
That's right.
So, a little bit of Shelly by your side.
Yeah, a little bit of Shelly by our side. So we've got Shelly Brown with us and Chad Morris. Thank you both for being here and being a part of the conversation.
We love it.
Kayla.
Present.
Yeah, present. let's talk a little bit about, so the last time we chatted, we spent a while talking about you getting that first book, CC. What's the full title?
CC Rios and the Desert of Souls. Or if you want to like not stress, it's CC Rios and the Desert of Souls. You can say it that way too. I'm okay with it.
I feel better saying it that way. Or I'll just refer to it as the CC series and do that. So one of the things that we want to talk about with that series is your Mexican culture and what that means to you and why you chose to set. Now, I know the first book takes place in Mexico. Is the series down in Mexico, the whole series, or?
Yes. Okay. Well, it is technically an alt world series, but it the place where it is, Antigua Amanecer, is basically, in my head, it's basically if Mexico was a really big island.
Okay.
Awesome. In an alternate world in the 1920s where, yeah.
So this is a fictional world that is heavily influenced by Mexican culture.
Yes.
Is that okay?
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it.
Yeah. Well, tell us a little bit about your ethnic background and why you wanted to have more representation in literature when it comes to Mexican culture.
Yeah. Well, you know, the interesting thing is it didn't even start out as a, like, I'm planting my feet down here and I'm gonna build the diversity. It just came out of personal experience and some really beautiful familial joy. So actually, when I was in college, I hadn't seen my abuelo since I was like 4 years old. You know, we lived kind of on the almost complete opposite side of the continent.
That is a long time.
Yeah. And so I was like, wait, I'm actually closer where I was out in at college. I was like, wait, I think I could actually make it to where he is. So one Christmas, I just decided to invite myself over to my abuelo's house and was like, hi, and showed up like, hello. Friends dropped me off when I made it there and visited with some family in the area as well, but mostly stayed with my abuelo for about that 2 week break. Mm-hmm. And it was such a lovely experience. You know, I mean, maybe at first a little awkward because you're like, hi, and he's like, hola. And I'm like, oh, wait, how much Spanish does he speak and how much English do I speak? Because he had taught himself.
You're like, I've already exhausted my Spanish in this conversation.
Oh, no. It's like, ¿cómo está? I don't have anything past that. And so it was.
And just
awkward.
So our audience knows, you grew up in Tennessee.
Yes,
right.
I grew up,
and
in
you
Tennessee.
Grew up speaking English. And,
yes.
And your father is
Mexican,
and it like is he 100% Mexican or like his? Okay, so his parents and everything from
both
Mexico.
Parents.
Your mother, on the other hand.
Is from England.
Yeah, not actually. Very Mexican at all.
No.
You are so international.
Yeah, I was like, honestly, I have no ancestors from here in the United States.
Well, Mexico is America.
Yes.
Yes,
so
that's true. That's
I could regale you about how Mexico actually is most of Western America.
Yeah.
But it was because of that. My dad never taught me Spanish. Mm-hmm. That's the same for sort of his whole generation. They grew up kind of civil rights era California. It was not a good thing to speak Spanish.
Yeah. And did your mom teach you the Queen's English then?
She taught me a pretty good accent. Actually, no. When I try, she's like, you sound sometimes like you're from Liverpool, and then sometimes you're like you're from here. And I was like, I love that you know that.
That's what I was going for.
Yeah, exactly.
So anyway, not to derail your story, you go to Mexico.
No.
California.
California. Okay, sorry.
California. I was Grandpa's not following. In California.
No, you're good.
Yeah.
My abuelo was actually technically born in Texas, right on the border. But he was brought over before he was like 1 year old into Mexico and raised there for like all of his formative years. And he was an adult when he moved to California. And he brought most of the family with him.
Gotcha.
And so he lived in California. Back where my parents used to live before they moved to Tennessee, before I was born.
Yeah.
And so I go and visit him, and the first problem is immediately, abuelo taught himself English. He was a very intelligent man. Mm-hmm. But he hadn't needed to use it in like over a decade.
Oh, gotcha.
Because all of his family speaks Espanol just fine, except me.
It's good practice. It's good for his brain to practice some Spanish, some English.
Working it out. Yeah. And so we end up finding this sort of mix of Spanglish, you know, where he can't remember the English word for it. I figure it out. He teaches me Spanish and we figure it out. You know, and actually, like, probably most of the Spanish that he taught me is in CC because I learned more Spanish in 2 weeks with him than in like the 2 years of high school I took.
Right. Well, you had great reason to learn.
Yeah, I was like, necessity.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah, and honestly, it was really fun because I watched as that sort of initial like, between us as we tried to figure out how to communicate, as that sort of devolved, there was all of this sort of joy of connecting. And he just loved to sit and tell me stories about his life. And that's exactly what I wanted, you know, like some other members of the family are like, are you too bored? You're just kind of sitting with like old people listening to their stories. I was like, this is the best time. This is how I party.
Love it.
So he told me all these stories about growing up in Mexico, and like the different experiences about his goat herd, about the time that he got lost in the cerros, which is like mountains. He and my abuela Clara, his third wife, they would argue about whether they're montañas or cerros, and like watching them argue about what's the most appropriate Spanish way. She's from Argentina, you know.
Nice.
And she's like, those aren't, it's montañas. And he's like, no, cerros. And she's like, no, the cerros is hills. Hills, Manuel. And I was just sitting there like, I'm enjoying every moment of this. And in throughout that experience, he told me about how all these like different interesting stories started cropping up. Not only what his life was like, you know, like growing up in the desert, watching his dad and his tios, his uncles, building an adobe house for them, you know, but also sort of the like brushes with the paranormal or like those really interesting things.
Chupacabra?
Like, yeah, well, not chupacabra, actually. La Llorona. How my bisabuelo, who was my great-grandpa, I never got to meet him. But he was traveling one night through like this dip between the cerros, montañas, whatever you want to call them. Whatever they are. There's this dip between them and there was a river. And they only had burros to travel, right? So they only had donkeys. And so my bisabuelo is coming home one night and he told my abuelo this and he told me, so it's kind of fun, how he was traveling by this riverside. Now, La Llorona is a pretty classic. It's very, very old myth, actually, but in its kind of modern incarnation, this legend about a woman who waits by rivers at night to drown you. And she's usually after children, but she'll take people. She'll take adults. You know, she will. And he's walking by right by a riverside at night, alone with his burro, and he sees something white drifting out the corner of his eye over the water, and he's like, oh my gosh, it's her. And he's terrified. He was a grown man by this point. He has many children, and he's just shaking in his boots. And like my abuelo told me, he was like, no, in Mexico, if you don't look at it, it can't get you.
Oh.
I was like, I don't know how true that is outside of our family.
It's got to be true. I lived by that as a child.
Yeah. Just explain it to her. I'm not looking, so you can't get me.
That's how it works, okay? Yeah. That's the moral building rules. And so he walked for like a mile, like stressfully, like not allowing himself
with
to
this
glance.
Thing in the river,
yeah,
following
him every step, and he's like, and he's like, don't look at it, and she can't get you. Don't go look at it, and she can't get you. But then he comes out of the mountain, so they part sort of into the broader desert. And I don't know why, but he couldn't take it any longer. So he finally whirled around to like look her in the eyes. He was so scared, like he just had to. And then she wasn't there, and he was like, what?
And it got him.
Where is she? And if I can't see her, did I lose her? Oh, crap, you know? Hey. And so he's like freaking out, trying to look around and find La Llorona. And then he starts to realize that his sombrero, it has strings. Oh. And it's a full moon. And they're white strings.
And they're just catching the corner of his eye.
It's so for like... All of that time, he'd been like sweating bullets, and it was just the moonlight catching on his sombrero strings. And he's like, ooh, feeling so, so silly. But honestly, I loved that story because I was like, I do that. It's like mm-hmm. when I'm like, there's a serial killer in my house, and then it's just my dishwasher. I was like, oh, yeah. Things like that.
Chad actually used to think that if somebody came to kill everybody in his family, you know, one of those things you think as a child.
Of course.
He had a plan. You want to tell him what that plan was, Chad?
I was a genius tiny kid. I laid down very flat in my bed, and I would put my cover right across my neck because I thought if a murderer came in, they'd look down at me and go, oh, this kid already had his head chopped off. I'll move on to the next one. That was my plan.
The other murderer must have already got this one.
Oh, my partner's already been here. But look, it obviously worked because
you're still
here.
Alive. Yeah. You're still alive.
That's, the killer never got you.
Who knows how many situations that got me out of.
That's well, growing fabulous. Up as a fat kid myself, that would not have worked for me.
Oh my gosh, I love that.
So you have this experience. Right. And let's talk about like bringing this into your books. What steps did you take for that? And when did you realize, hey, I've got this culture that I want to mine for flavor or whatever it is, right. To create this world with, walk us through that.
Yeah. So I have this amazing experience with my abuelo and meeting the rest of the Mexican side of the family. And that experience sort of made me feel like I'd gathered a piece of me that was missing. Mm-hmm. I loved everything else. I loved my British culture. I've gone over to England and spent a lot of time with the family there. But this was the first time I felt like I'd gotten that piece. And then I felt just a little bit more whole, mm-hmm. I guess is the best way to put mm-hmm. that. And so when I went home, I've told you last episode kind of how the story went down, right? But I was, you know, I'd sent off a different manuscript and I was working on another manuscript for years previous to this, or I'm probably exaggerating, maybe like a year. I had had this idea about what if we had souls on the outside of our body, like on necklaces.
Yeah.
And I had tried two different attempts of like a contemporary fantasy, you know, sort of blank canvas-y, you know, classic main character. And I had been trying so many different ways to make that work, and none of them did. I spent so much word count trying to make that work.
None of it's wasted. You became a better writer.
Yes, more practice, more of my 10,000
more
hours.
Lines, yeah. More lines.
That's how you get better. And suddenly, like when I came back, I was just really excited, like looking up all of this Mexican folklore, because I had loved folklore and mythology as a kid. My nanny in England, and no, I don't mean like person who watches you. That's what we call our grandma in England. Yeah. So my nanny had sent over like Celtic folklore, Gaelic folklore. So I was like really well versed in that kind of stuff as a child. And I just never found Mexican folklore, Mexican mythology, mm-hmm. none of that. That was just not available. I still have trouble finding it. There's just like a few books that I rely on.
Right.
And so I went home and was like Googling as much as I could. Yeah. Cause again, hard to find, and putting things into Google Translate to try to like for the, like, cause mm-hmm. a lot of it's in Spanish if there is available.
Right.
And so like piecing together, but I was so excited cause, Abuelo told me about curanderas and brujería and like all of these different things, he'd experienced. And I was looking it up and I came across one that's El Sombrerón. Now, El Sombrerón is actually like originally, well, it's hard to originate a lot of stuff in sort of
sure.
Latin America.
Well, but, in cultures where so much is oral.
Right.
That's just the fact.
Yeah. Exactly. And where languages change so much.
Yes.
El Sombrerón originally was like further south. I can't remember if it was Venezuela now or not. I know El Cebón is. Anyway, the point being, I came across the story of El Sombrerón, and it had traveled up into sort of southern parts of Mexico. And it's a story about this sort of like impish character. He's mm-hmm. somewhere between extremely sinister and extremely silly. Mm-hmm. And I love how both of those can just mm-hmm. exist in mythology.
Yeah.
Where he's like this, he's supposed to be like 3 feet tall. He wears a gigantic hat. That's what his hat,
yeah,
name
that's his
means.
Name. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I was wondering when that was coming in.
He's the hat because he's bigger than him, honestly. But his whole thing is he's got a silver guitar and he comes in the middle of the night and plays it and hypnotizes basically young beautiful women, mm-hmm. and they come out of their house and
just
steals
the
them
beautiful
away.
Ones.
Yes, the more beautiful, the more yeah. danger you're in.
Yeah.
And then he steals
story
them
of my life. Just yeah, so you know.
I know. and then he steals them away. He also does impish things like he braids your horse's tail and
oh
my goodness,
it. How ridiculous.
Horses hate that.
Yeah, yeah. It's so annoying, man. I'm under the braid every day. so he's somewhere, but I was like really struck by how sinister this silly kind of character yeah. was. I was like, wait, did you just say he kidnaps women in the middle of the night? What? And then you're like, oh, but he also like braids hair. Oh. I'm like, I'm not over.
But I'm still on but, the kidnapping.
But, yeah.
I'm kind of stuck on that, guys. Go back.
But what if I do not look at his hat?
Yeah. What if I don't listen to the silver guitar?
Yes, exactly.
Yes. So I was really struck by this and was like, bro, that would make such a good villain, such mm-hmm. a good antagonist. And then I was like, wait. And got really excited because I was like, wait, that story, that idea, souls on the outside. I was like, desert, yeah. Mexican mythology, El Sombrerón. I was like, okay, well, if El Sombrerón was the antagonist, who, like, what would sort of the main conflict be? I'm like, well, he steals girls. What if there's no more powerful thing than wanting to protect somebody you love, right?
Right.
More powerful motivation if it was your sister that he had stolen. Mm. And then you have to try and get her back. And I was like, oh,
I got a story.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was so filled with sort of that desert heat and danger of Mexican mythology. There's such duality in it, beauty and suffering, danger and nobility. You know, like it's all the way back to Mayan times. Mexico has had a very strong sense of duality. In fact, most ancient cultures have some of it, right? But it's just a very strong thing, of a sense of bothness in the culture. And that's something that's important to me, especially as someone who has been, you know, bicultural, you know, like both,
right.
and so I just set off, like, let me capture all of them, like scooping a bunch of mythology off the shelves, crushing it all into my shopping cart of my enthusiasm. And and I sit down and I just write. And I remember the first chapter is not what I wrote. That night was the second chapter that currently of CC. Very little has changed, in fact, besides maybe like ages and stuff like that. But I sat down and I wrote 10,000 words that night. I was so excited. I think it was like 5 a.m. when I stopped. And I was like, I'm so tired. But I wanted to keep going. It was that exciting. And it was capturing all of this feeling of reconnecting with these things, or discovering perhaps even this part of me that mattered a lot to me. and my familia and their experiences. Like, there's little things in there that are there because they're in the stories Abuelo told me. Even down to, like, the goats, you know, and the cerros. I was like, yeah, they're going to be cerros in my book. Nice. Not montañas.
Of course not.
Yeah. And that was just such a lovely experience. And it stayed throughout the whole thing. It had such an identity about it. That the more I wrote, it just felt right and it came together. In fact, I think I finished CC in a month.
Wow.
That is fast. Yeah. That's very fast.
I like to think of it as like I have to bottle lightning real fast.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we have all this mythology that you're taking from the Mexican culture and story stuff. What about your protagonist? How important was it for CC to represent in that way for you?
Yeah, well, as I wrote it, I realized that everyone just was Mexican because the place was Mexico.
in your fantasy Mexico.
Right, yeah, yeah. This is my fantasy Mexico. Everybody just is this. In fact, there's a point where CC points out Kit Fox is the only character who's lighter, and it's because Kit Foxes are very pale. Mm-hmm. But she was like, wow, what a weirdly pale child. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's unusual to her because everybody else is just brown. And I made her browner than I am. But what I didn't realize is that, you know, a lot of her journey is about kindness and about the strength of kindness. In fact, like the metal strength of kindness. And at the same time, learning to be brave and accept that and embrace that. But one of the things that started to evolve, even throughout revisions, was this sense of, CeCe ended up kind of representing how I feel, and I didn't realize it even mm-hmm. when I was writing it, but I looked back and was like, oh, yeah, that's it, which is that she's stuck between things in her own culture because she, in Tierra del Sol, where she lives, the people have come to a belief because there was a very bad criatura attack on their town, and there's like a ring of ruins around what's left of their town because of it. And so they have this very strong belief that they are children of the sun, which is also true in the mythology, the context of the story. But because that they are children of the sun, they need to embrace heat and fire, and they even have fire opal that glows because of the fire in their souls and all of this kind of stuff. Because souls are very important in the story because some people's souls are on the outside of their body. and because of this whole experience, CeCe is not like them. She can't make fire opal glow. She has mercy on a criatura who tells her that she will have water in her soul and no one will have the power to make her burn. And everybody thinks it's a curse. Mm. So she's sort of stranded in this awkward place. She's not a criatura, a child of the desert. She is a child of the sun technically, but she doesn't seem to have the fiery soul everyone wants from her. And even the criaturas are like, what are you doing when she's being nice? Stuff right, like right. that. Stop that. I don't know what to do when you cry. Don't do that. but she has, therefore, this sort of stranded experience. And then throughout the book starts to carve her own way, kind of like a river.
Right.
I should have put that in there. Look at that. Well, yes, Rios actually means river. Yeah. Bro, look, I'm a genius.
You were doing stuff on other levels. You didn't realize.
Dang. but she has this experience of carving out her own way, and not in this sort of like, she doesn't reject other options because of it. She finds her way through them and with them. She gains friends, criaturas, by being who she is. She creates connection and sort of starts to change even the culture of her town in pieces, those who are receptive, and her own family, because she's being who she is. And she starts to realize that, yes, that is what I'm going to do. I'm going to pick being, like, I will pick kindness for all of them. And that is the road she carves. That is the river she carves throughout the story. And I realized that is growing up. I kind of felt like I just was the wrong parts of both things. Like, oh no, I'm
a little too one for the other and a little too other for the one.
Exactly. With my culture. I mean, I grew up in Tennessee. I didn't have an accent. I have a Mexican-American father. I have a British mother. And so that does not equal a Southern accent at all. and I my mom has a very different view of American culture than most people. You know, she's the kind of person where she sees people being like, whoa, 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 about awards. And she's like, are you guys okay? Are you guys okay?
How absolutely animal of them.
Yes. Well, not even in that way, but in a like, because my mom isn't from the sort of posh stock, as she would put it. She's from the very common people of England who are more likely to take you down a notch if you're trying to be too much. Gotcha. But it's just very different because in England, you're almost more proud of how every man you are.
Okay.
But here in America, because we're kind of a survival of the fittest meritocracy, mm-hmm. culturally at least.
Individualistic.
Yeah. That she's like, so everybody's just trying to like out award each other till they die. You know?
Yeah.
She's never said it's
kind
like
of the
that.
Opposite. Yeah.
Yeah. Where everyone's trying to climb over everyone to get a thing. And so she has a very different view on that. And then my dad has a very different view being, you know, I mean, he grew up during the civil rights era of California, which really affected his growing up. And so he didn't teach any of us Spanish, and somewhere between really loving his culture and completely rejecting it, which I think is very common for second generation anyway.
I've heard that the first generation embrace, second rejects, and then third kind of reclaims is kind of the not to oversimplify,
that is about right. Yeah. And I was like, perfectly in the position to reclaim. Yeah, yeah. Woo. And so because of those things, and even down to the way I look in some ways, I'm the palest daughter in my family. Mm-hmm. So I got my mom's beautiful British skin. But I didn't think I looked like her because she's got beautiful light eyes and she's got beautiful lighter hair. And so I was like, oh, no, I don't look like a white person. Right. And then I didn't look like a brown person. Right. Because gotcha. I was too pale. And therefore, you know, as a teenager, your acne and all this. And you're like, oh, white people got it harder when acne. It all shows. There's no hiding it. No disguising. So like even things like that was like, I just felt like I came out wrong, even down to my hair. No mm-hmm. one knew what to do with my hair because it's somewhere like a perfect crossbreed between Celtic thick waves and coarse, heavy, thick waves of the Spanish, you know, side. And I was like, oh. And so as soon as I hit puberty, it was like, oh, I don't even know what to do with myself, what I am. I don't even, you know, there's so many things. I have no idea how to be this thing that didn't exist before. Neither of my parents know how to be half
right,
the other.
Right.
And so that was a whole journey of feeling stuck in between. And I remember it was sometime in college. I think it was actually probably right before CC. So maybe I came into the book with some of more of this wisdom, but where that sort of settled, even from reading, and actually some of it settled simply because I was reading books from other cultures where people and immigrant sort of literature. I remember I read, something of maladies. I should remember it if it was this important to me. Healer of Maladies. I don't know. It's Indian, set of Indian short stories. And they're all kinds of just different Indian diaspora sort of experiences. And I remember feeling so comforted because a lot of those things that I hadn't had words for or hadn't really known how to unpack, that the whole short stories is all about the different parts of that. And so I suddenly was like, oh, they feel the same thing of like, maybe I'm a broken off piece of something larger. What do I do about that? Right. And then I sort of realized, oh, well, if I'm in the cracks between culture, maybe I'm not in the cracks between culture. Maybe that just means I get to pick all of it.
Yeah. Yeah. Instead of rejecting both or getting rejected by both, you're in this place perfect. Where you can claim everything.
Yeah. And so I was like, yeah, that's what I'm going to pick. I pick both. I pick all.
I pick both. Yeah. I love that. Yeah. I pick all.
And that's like what Cece ends up having to do. She doesn't reject the criatura. She doesn't reject her town. She has to be in this difficult place of trying to love it all, which is, again, sometimes difficult, you know, especially when pieces of them don't love you back.
Yeah.
But she chooses that for herself. And that starts to give other people the same option. And so it was really a really nice experience to be able to like pour that into Cece, that understanding that I come to, which, you know, visiting my abuelo had really helped with, where I was like, yeah, I get to have both. maybe I don't speak Spanish fluently. And am I slightly embarrassed about it? Yes.
Yeah.
I know my abuelo would have loved it if I had learned more fluently.
Tell me about this. I know part of what you do as an author is go to schools, right, and do school visits. Tell me about those school visits and how the kids react to Cece, especially maybe some Latina girls at the school, and because I'm sure a lot of the books they pick up don't represent them the way that Cece is going to
middle grade space, so, you know, young. Young adult, you can find much better representation, but
well, especially now, like with
middle grade,
sort
is still
of,
a little tricky.
Yeah, 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 exactly. Well, actually, there's one school visit in particular I think that sort of represents. This is the one that sticks out in my mind. It represents sort of what that feels like to me. So I went to this one. I was invited. I was even paid. Ooh,
hey,
that sounds nice.
And they had a high Latino population, which is why I think they wanted that, or Latine. And there was this this girl. So I was up on the stage and I was telling them like these stories and telling them about Cece and things like that, just being very myself. And then we had a little break because there, you know, the presentation assembly was over, and then the next was going to be the other half of the students, sort of the older half, fifth graders, where I was going to do a workshop with them, right? So I got down from the stage to go and get some water because I'm like, after presenting like that. And one of the girls is walking by. She's probably going to the bathroom too or something. And she's like, hey. And I was like, hey. Because, you know, extra chipper.
Right, right.
And she was like, Amo Rivera too. And I was like, hermana. And she just grinned. And we didn't even chat for too long. But, you know, it was like I had never met somebody before with my last name. So that was just cool for me. And I think it was for her too. Of course, she's like in fifth or sixth grade. So she's trying to be like a little cool, you know.
Right. But she wanted you to know.
Yeah, she approached me. That takes something for, you know, fifth to sixth grader. So we chat and things like that. And then, you know, we go through the workshop and I'm talking to lots of different people and things like that. And then I get an email from the teacher later. And she says that she was like, I think you worked a miracle the other day when you came. She's like, that girl who came up to you, the Rivera. And I was like, the Rivera, yeah. She was like, she's been a very difficult student. She doesn't turn her things in. She, you know, like some behavioral things, some difficulties and stuff like that. Possibly from financial situations, things like that. You know, I don't know if she was speculating or, you know, but she tells me, she's like, but since your visit and since getting to talk to you, getting to see a beautiful, this is her words. I'm not saying this about myself.
I would use the word gorgeous, but she said beautiful.
Muy hermosa. she was like a beautiful, powerful woman, an author who created this work and about people like her. She's like, ever since that experience, she has been nonstop writing. She's turned in all of her work. She's completely turned around in school. And I think I cried when I read that, because I was like, that when there is something when we're growing up where sometimes we deselect ourselves without even realizing it.
Right.
And there are sometimes events, moments, gateway books, gateway experiences that make us realize we don't have to deselect ourselves. And I think that can happen in multiple different ways, but I'm really grateful I got to be that experience for that little Rivera, that little Reverita, you know? It was like she was able to see a Latina girl can go on and do something important. You are capable of this. Just because it maybe was difficult or you thought it wasn't for you for whatever reason, we have to like sometimes crack those shells off of ourselves, those things that we have just, why did I think that? Right. With something that contradicts it. And I'm glad I got to be that experience for her. And it showed me why. Because sometimes doing author events and things like that, I love school visits. I need to say that first. I love them.
Yeah,
but that sometimes doing author events and things like that, it's exhausting.
It is exhausting.
Or I'm like, I'm so tired. I really hope I last till the end of the day, you know, stuff like that. And sometimes I'm like, why did I sign up for this again? Maybe fewer next time or something. And then I have experiences like that, or there are little moments where a girl comes up to me and says, I used to be scared like Cece, and now I've enrolled in Taekwondo and I'm doing all these things because I realize I could be brave too because she's brave. And I was like, those moments are the ones where you're like, absolutely worth being exhausted for. Just even the opportunity to maybe be that gateway experience for somebody is so worth it.
I love that. I love that so much. Just hearing how your work, your effort, your growth, everything that you're experiencing and then giving to the world, and then all of a sudden it just ripples and helps other people and find themselves, and it's just that rippling effect for good is just so beautiful to hear. And here's something else that we all know intuitively, like you only know a portion of the good that your books and stories have done, right? There, for every one brave little girl who comes up and tells you what you did for her, I'm sure there's hundreds of others that schools that you didn't get to go to, or girls that might have been a little too afraid to go up and talk to you, and we're still learning that bravery. And so to have your work go out in the world like that is just a beautiful thing.
Yeah, and you know, oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to add something, if that's all right.
Yes.
That, like a cool, so like I read Cece and I loved it.
And he's not a little
and
Latina.
I'm not seeing myself, you know, I'm this middle middle American white guy out of Utah. That
elderly
bald dude. Nobody's writing me emails telling me how gorgeous I am. I'm just saying. But one of the cool things about what we're talking about is like portraying this cool culture with like new myths. I mean, they're not new, but maybe a lot of people don't know about them.
Yeah.
Right? Like to me, walking into that world, it felt old and new at the same time. Right? It's like based on all these ancient things, but like I didn't grow up watching movies about criaturas and brujas, and you know, it was like, oh, this is a whole new kind of adventure kind of thing. Coyote's awesome. You know, there's these, it felt like discovery in some fun, unique ways, right? Which is great. And also I'd hope for lots of readers out there, it kind of just helps to like open your mind to other cultures and ideas beyond yours. I know it's just a fictional story, right?
Right.
Based on these other myths, but it's a great blessing from reading
fictional
widely.
Stories.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway,
well, like how like an Indian set of short stories is like
right.
a
Helped
big part
you.
Of yeah me yeah. feeling seen. And I think you're right too in that like it's actually shows you how in being able to identify and see our cultural differences, it actually brings us closer very often because we're like, oh, I felt that before. Even if it's, you felt it in a different way, but now there's a bond. Now they're not as dissimilar or other than you.
Right. I've walked by a river and thought, yeah. there's something that might be trying to, no, seriously.
No, like I was going to say, no, it's going to the bathroom at the campground in the middle of the night, right? Yeah, we've all walked through that forest and
they
thought,
just gave
shoot.
It a name, you know, now
terrifies.
I know what to be afraid of.
The feeling of being watched in the middle of the night when you're near water is La Llorona for everybody.
Yeah.
And one other thing that's genius about your story, though, is like the parts of it came as you're like digging deeper into, you know, your family, your past, you know, for authors out there that are looking for stories, it is really interesting to like look around the cultures around you or even where you come from. Mm-hmm. Like the more you know, the more ideas you might get, which I think is a fun insight.
I like one of the things Chad said there, which was the story felt new and old at the same time, right? And not having read the book myself, here's what I get out of that description. New meaning fresh, like he's never seen something like this before. But old meaning like it's been worn, right? Like it's been lived in. You know, you think of like speaking my language when it comes to like film that I work in. If you see wardrobe, that you're like, that has clearly not been lived in.
Yes.
Ancient Greece turns out brand new robes.
Yeah. and everything's creased and bright white and whatever. It's to be able to tell a story that is both fresh and lived in is awesome. I know. Well, actually, tell me a little bit about some of the mythical creatures that you came up with, or are you pulling
the fresh stuff?
Yeah. Are you how much of these creatures in your book are like straight up, this comes from mythology, and I just maybe put a little twist on it to like, this is my whole thing and nobody's ever seen this before. Where do we live in this that space?
Yes. Okay. Well, I also love doing things. I'm absolutely, like I mentioned last episode, I'm a little chaotic, you know, chaotic little bottle of gremlin. And I therefore also bring that into my book. So I did give myself rules, you know, where I was like, okay, it has to actually be a legend and stuff, except for if I really want it to not be.
There's hard and fast rules.
I like your soft magic lines. Yes. I'm seeing them now. Yeah.
You can feel it. Exactly. So for example, the Black Lion, the creator of the Black Lion, he's one of the kind of main characters in the book. Completely made up. That does not exist anywhere, I don't think, at all. Absolutely no roots. I just thought it was awesome. I was like, yes, I love it. It's a fantasy. I can do it.
Right.
They didn't know all the legends. You know?
Yeah, you know, I can make things too. and then there were also things like Coyote. Who is, I leaned into, there's lots of different stories about Coyote. Mm-hmm. He's always a shapeshifter. He's always a trickster. But I also gave him edges that I wanted to explore of like somebody who is a tricky and mysterious, not because they're unknowable, but because they are unsure about you. And they have hesitance with you and they don't know whether to trust you.
Which I think is a real coyote.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly. And then there's sort of like boundaries with the criaturas. So I had animal criaturas and I had, because shapeshifters is a huge thing in mm-hmm. Mexican folklore as well, like coyote. So animal shapeshifters. And then I had the dark criaturas who are just kind of like ghouls. Like, because that's the other kind, you know, of story in Mexican folklore and legend is like ghoulish ghost monster thingies, and you're like, I don't even know how to describe this, but it's gonna go under dark criatura. and that's where you get El Sombrerón, that's where you get La Llorona, that's where you get El Stilbon. I gave myself some rules with them, but I also twisted things. So for example, El Stilbon is dropped in pretty much the way he is, which is to me one of the most sympathetic folkloric characters, and you get more into that in the second book. But a character who was cursed to carry his father's bones on his back because he killed his father, because his father either killed his wife or his daughter or both. It kind of depends on the version. But either way, I was like, I think that was fine in my opinion. I'm on his side. but that he's called the Whistler. That's what El Silbon means. So when you hear the whistle, he's coming kind of thing. But if it's far away, he's actually near. If you hear it near, he's actually far, you know. So tricky. But El Silbon also is typically seen as, like, in Venezuela, where it originally comes from, he's also kind of seen as, like, I guess kind of a vigilante of, like, bad men who hurt women. El Silbon's going to, like, mess you up, you know? And I was like, I kind of love that.
Yeah.
El Silbon's going to be, like, a complicated good guy in my story. but El Sombrerón, who is kind of his opposite in many ways, where he's like, I'm going to steal your girls. Nah. I thought that was, I liked the combination of silly and sinister. It's very folkloric, right. You know? But I wanted to lean into that pretty straight. So what I did instead of like having him as like a kind of 3-foot imp and he kind of braids hair. Instead, I leaned in and was like, how can we make that as creepy as possible? And instead, I made him like 8-foot tall. I made him have like red glowing eyes. In some depictions, he does have that. That's kind of artistic depending, you know. And I made him have, you know, the silver guitar and the same hypnotic powers and things like that. And I made him when he steals girls, he transforms their souls into braids of hair, like like little serial killer trophies.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so I was like, I'm gonna lean, because where he plays into the story is absolute misuse of power over other people, controlling them, absolute cruelty. And therefore representing that, I was like, I'm not going to do like silly little guy who who braids your horse's hair. No, I'm going to have like almost serial killer vibes with this guy. So I did twisting things like that. Most of the things that I twisted, I did on purpose for to highlight theme, though. Like even the Kurin, like there is real curanderismo and there is real brujería. I have taken them and they are sort of, they are fictionalized versions of those things. So I do hope no one is like, oh, this is what curanderas do, right? I'm like, no, gotcha. That's not that's not what they do. It's much more, there's much more to it.
It's just what I have them do.
Yeah, so like this is just, you know, this is not, yes, this is what I want them to do. and they have different distinctions and things like that. And I created the gods in the story. There are four, you know, and they're brothers and sisters. Three sisters, one brother. And I did create them, and they are completely, in many ways, kind of unique. I say that kind of because there were like gods of oceans and things like that. They're just not similar to the ones I made. But they also run by the same sort of ancient Aztec roots, where in like ancient Aztec roots, there's this belief of sort of like the turning of time, and that the gods have to sacrifice themselves for every age of humanity. That's why like Aztecs were really big about blood, is they actually believed that the gods actually basically died and gave blood for human beings to exist. Mm. And that's where sacrifice, this concept of sacrifice came from. It's like, oh, the god is weak because there's a drought. We have to give some back. They're too weak, you know, which is kind of beautiful in its own way. And also like, oh no, in other ways.
Absolutely terrifying as yeah, well.
Exactly. I'm like, I don't agree, but I see how you created that logic. and so I wanted to retain sort of that idea, which is why the gods, for example, while being quite different in my version, they're very benevolent gods, for example. That's just unusual in myths to begin with. but that they sacrificed themselves to become no longer sort of like these living entities, but instead to be the land that they walk on and the sun that they are warmed from, the ocean that they sail on. You know, like they are those actual physical bodies now. Sacrificed because they wanted human beings to be. And that's like, that wraps up into some of the ancient Aztec, like it's in the shape, I guess I would say, yeah. of the ancient Aztec traditions. So there's a lot of, I'm trying to respect the shape of things, mm-hmm. you know, because I realize people are going to experience it, and some of them genuinely think the black lion's a real thing. And I'm like, no, I'm sorry.
but that's great. I mean, if they see a bunch of things that are real from that mythology and other stuff is being added to it, but it still fits, right? It still feels like it belongs. That's a good tell for your book, right? That says it's going in the right direction.
My world building revisions, they worked. Yeah.
Well, Kayla, thanks so much for joining us again here. We're going to wrap up another episode. Just real quick, give us the quick pitch on your book coming out and when people can get it.
Yes. Well, you can pre-order The Hungry Forest now. It comes out August 18th, 2026. And it comes out from Bloomsbury. And it is about two boys, Ryan and Teddy, who have recently lost their father. And then they start to hear his voice coming from the local haunted forest. They know they shouldn't go in, but they can't help the longing and the because of the grief. But when they go inside, they start to realize all the stories were not just stories. They're true. And they will have to face all of the crazy, cursed, masked monsters inside, as well as the monsters inside themselves and each other in order to get out before the sun rises. And they're stuck there forever.
Awesome. Right thanks on. For thanks so much for sharing that. Thanks for being on another episode. We get you for one more episode. Woo! And so I will make a promise right now to everybody that this next episode is going to be horrific. And yes! So you'll get more on that
it's the best.
The next time we come back. But thanks again for joining us on another episode of Mulling It Over.